Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to another News in Focus program. We're looking at an article that was posted August 19, 2012 at 1 a.m. in the morning. And it's written by Neil Ferguson. Neil Ferguson is a contributor to Newsweek magazine. This is the cover article of Newsweek magazine. It has a picture of our president on the front of it, and he's carrying his jacket in his left hand. And the title is Hit the Road, Brock, Why We Need a New President by Neil Ferguson. Neil is spelled N-I-A-L-L. I sure hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm sure if I'm not, someone will let me know. Neil writes, I was a good loser 4 years ago. In the grand scheme of history, I wrote the day after Barack Obama's election as president. 4 decades is not an especially long time. Yet in that period, America has gone from the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. to the presidency of Barack Obama. Okay, so that's the transitional movement that he's saying. You would not be human if you fail to acknowledge this as a cause for great rejoicing. And of course, I would have to agree. I would have to agree. Despite having been, full disclosure, an advisor to John McCain, I, the writer, Neil, acknowledged his opponent's remarkable qualities, his soaring oratory, his cool, hard-to-ruffle temperament, and his near-faultless campaign organization. Yet the question confronting the country nearly 4 years later is not who was the better candidate 4 years ago. It is whether the winner has delivered on his promises, and the sad truth is that he has not. In his inaugural address, Obama promised not only to create new jobs, but to lay a new foundation for growth. He promised to build the roads and bridges, electrical grids, digital lines that feed our commerce and bind us together. He promised to restore science to its rightful place and wield technology's wonders to raise healthcare's quality and lower its costs. And he promised to transform our schools and colleges and universities to meet the demands of a new age. Unfortunately, the president's scorecard on every single one of those bold pledges is pitiful. In an unguarded moment earlier this year, the president commented that the private sector of the economy was doing fine. Certainly, the stock market is well up by 74% relative to the close on Inauguration Day 2009. But the total number of private sector jobs is still 4.3 million below the January 2008 peak. Meanwhile, since 2008, a staggering 3.6 million Americans have been added to Social Security's disability insurance program. This is one of the many ways unemployment is being concealed. In his fiscal 2010 budget, the first he presented, the president envisioned growth of 3.4% in 2010, 4.0% in 2011, 4.6% in 2012. Actual numbers were 4.2, 1.8, and few forecasters now expect anything more than 2.3. Unemployment was supposed to be 6% by now. It has averaged 8.2 this year. Meanwhile, real median household income has dropped more than 5% since 2009. And nearly 110 million individuals received a welfare benefit in 2011, mostly Medicaid. Medicaid, as I will remind you, is for those that are younger, or food stamps, also known as SNAP. Welcome to Obama's America. Nearly half the population is not represented on a taxable return. On a taxable return. That doesn't mean they don't file the return. This is my commentary now. That doesn't mean they don't file the return. A taxable return is a return in which actual tax was paid. Almost exactly the same proportion that lives in a household where at least one member receives some type of government benefit. Now, some type of government benefit would then include Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, or food stamps, or some other smaller assistance program. But those are the big ones. Let's go over them again. Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, or food stamps. Neil writes, we are becoming the 50-50 nation, half of us paying the taxes and the other half receiving the benefits. Neil Ferguson discusses Obama's broken promises on Face the Nation, and that is a unique interview that if you have the time, you should go on and listen to. I did, and what you find is that Bob Schieffer cuts Neil off as much as he can. He just interrupts him and keeps him from communicating what he believes to be a message that we need to hear. This, of course, is on CBS. Neil continues in this Newsweek magazine, and all of this despite a far bigger hike in the federal debt than we were promised. According to 2010 budget, the debt in public hands was supposed to fall in relationship to the GDP. Let me remind you, the GDP is the gross domestic product, from 67% to less than 66% this year, if only by the end of this year, according to the Congressional Budget Office, also known as CBO. It will reach 70% of the GDP. These figures significantly understate the debt problem. However, the ratio that matters in debt to revenue, that number has leaped upward from 165% in 2008 to 262% this year, according to figures from the International Monetary Fund. Among developed economies, only Ireland and Spain have seen a bigger deterioration. And the fact is, the article goes on and it's just packed with numbers on top of numbers on top of numbers. And the reality is it contains charts that illustrate the problems. It compares the recovery. The problem is no one's going to read this article. I mean, honestly, what percentage of Americans will actually read this entire article? I have. I sat at lunch and I read through the entire thing. The numbers are overwhelming. They're confusing at times. They're difficult to grab a hold of. And the fact of the matter is, with the short attention span of the typical American, numbers, quite frankly, bore us to death. If you're as old as I am, you can remember in 1992 and 1996, when Ross Perot was running for president of the United States, and he came out there with charts and he came out there with numbers, and he was trying to help us understand where the problems are with regard to the economy, with regard to the debt, with regard to unemployment. And, well, he never became president of the United States, because that just doesn't work. What works is empty promises. What works is cool speeches. What works is tall, slender, attractive, articulate, and that's where we're at. You promise everything. You promise to change Washington, and then you realize this is a monster beyond anyone's wildest imagination, and the ability to affect change is nearly impossible. I mean, let's just look at these numbers, and probably by now you're already bored and you've left the commentary. But we're talking about percentage points movements of 2%, 1%, 0.5%. I mean, this is hard. This is a major movement. To move unemployment from 8 to 6 is a significant movement. You say it's only 2 percentage points. No, what you're really failing to understand, that it's 2 points of an 8, which is a 25% reduction in the number of unemployed. Thus, it makes it a substantial movement. The article goes on and it just continues to pack itself with number after number. He says, on paper, it looked like an economics dream team. Larry Summers, Romer, Goolsby, not to mention Peter Orszag, Tim Geithner, Paul Volcker. But the inside story, however, is that the president was wholly unable to manage the mighty brains and egos he had assembled to advise him. Now, that's completely a subjective remark with really just a complete bias there, because we have no idea what goes on inside the White House. We have no idea to what degree the president is actually able to manage his own staff. We can't do that. We don't know how to get inside there. One person says one thing, another person says another thing. The article goes on to talk about Obamacare and states that it really should be called Pelosi Care because she's the one that made it happen. And the article argues, Neil argues, that the president pledged that health care reform would not add a cent to the deficit, but the CBO and a joint committee on taxation now estimate that the insurance coverage provisions of the ACA, that's also known as Obamacare, will have a net cost of close to $1 trillion over the next 10 years. So that's $100 billion a year. And then he goes on and provides a wonderful chart to explain how America is losing ground in comparison to China with regard to the gross domestic product. The president's struggling right now, and understandably so. The president is struggling with Afghanistan. I did a previous commentary on the struggles in Afghanistan with insiders killing our own soldiers. And yesterday he did a press conference on that very issue. And his answer, quite frankly, was unsatisfactory. And of course, you believe at that moment that I'm being judgmental, but I can assure you that if it was your son or if it was your daughter that died at the hands of an Afghan recruit with a weapon that was provided by the United States, a bullet that was provided by the United States, and training that was provided by the United States, you would not think that I was being political or judgmental. If it was your nephew or your niece that volunteered to serve in the United States, and then you found out that he or she died in combat at the hands of an Afghan recruit, I believe that you would not think me to be too judgmental. Finally, the article transitions to a discussion about Paul Ryan. A discussion about Paul Ryan. He writes, Neil writes, I first met Paul Ryan in April 2010. I had been invited to a dinner in Washington where the U.S. fiscal crisis was going to be the top of the discussion. So crucial did this subject seem to me that I expected the dinner to happen in one of the city's biggest hotel ballrooms. It was actually held in the host's home. Three congressmen showed up, a sign of how successful the president's fiscal version of Don't Ask, Don't Tell about the debt had been. Ryan blew me away. I have wanted to see him in the White House ever since. It remains to be seen if the American public is ready to embrace the radical overhaul of the nation's finances that Ryan proposes. The public mood is deeply ambivalent. The president's approval rating is down to 49%. The Gallup Economic Confidence Index is at a minus 28, down from a minus 13 in May. But Obama is still narrowly ahead of Romney in the polls as far as the popular vote is concerned. 50.8 to 48.2 is the number he quotes, and comfortably ahead in the Electoral College. The pollsters say that Paul Ryan's nomination is not a game changer. Indeed, he is a high-risk choice for Romney because so many people feel nervous about the reforms Ryan proposes. But one thing is clear. Ryan psychs Obama out. This has been apparent ever since the White House went on the offense against Ryan in the spring of last year. And the reason he psychs him out is that, unlike Obama, Ryan has a plan as opposed to a narrative for this country. Mitt Romney is not the best candidate for the presidency, I can imagine, but he was clearly the best of the Republican contenders for the nomination. He brings to the presidency precisely the kind of experience, both in the business world and the executive office, that Barack Obama manifestly lacked 4 years ago. If only Obama had worked at Bain Capital for a few years instead of a community organizer in Chicago, he might understand exactly why the private sector is not doing fine right now. And I might add, just as a moment of my own commentary, and the president might also understand why small businesses are built by individuals and not by the government. And by picking Ryan as his running mate, continuing to read from Neil's commentary, and by picking Ryan as his running mate, Romney has given the first real sign that, unlike Obama, he has a courageous leader who will not duck the challenges America faces. The voters now face a stark choice. They can let Barack Obama's rambling narrative continue until they find themselves living in some American version of Europe with low growth, high unemployment, even higher debt, and real geopolitical decline, or they can opt for real change, the kind of change that will end 4 years of economic underperformance, stop the terrifying accumulation of debt, and reestablish a secure fiscal foundation for America's national security. So that's what you have. And the sad situation is I'm going to just take a wild guess, because I'm an uneducated wild guess, and say that maybe one percentage point of the total voting population will actually read this article. Maybe one percentage point, perhaps. Maybe not even that many, because when we think of 300 million Americans, how many of those are of voting age? Perhaps 200 million. How many of those are registered? Perhaps 150 million. Of those 150 million that are registered, how many will actually go out and vote on that day? Perhaps 40%. So now we're down to 60 million. And of those 60 million, how many will actually read this article? Perhaps 1 million. Perhaps 1 million. Maybe not even 1 million. I'd have to do a little research. My point is that apathy is plaguing America. And if you're a Christian that's becoming apathetic toward these things, ask yourself, is this sin? Ask yourself, is my apathy sin? Well, thanks for listening. Have a great day.